Sometimes for our teams, it can take up to 20 hours to do a round trip to collect the aid, which is obscene when this crossing is just a few kilometers away. And then, of course, if we do successfully collect the aid, we have to take it out of the crossing again with permission. We often have to travel down a designated route, which is not always a route that we would want to choose to take. Perhaps it's not safe. Perhaps it's a route we know where there are armed criminal gangs attempting to loot the aid. So there's so many obstacles that we face, and what we're repeatedly calling for is for these obstacles to be addressed. There are clear solutions. Give the UN more access to collect from the crossings, give us multiple safe routes inside of the Gaza Strip, and more important than anything, allow more trucks to come in, because we know that if we flood the Gaza Strip with aid, we will, one, reach more people with the supplies that they need, but two, we will address this desperation among the community and we will see the looting decrease.
Do you think your response to the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu rejecting the IPCC famine report, calling it an outright lie, yet at the same time not allowing an international journalist to verify what's going on the ground?
To suggest that this report is a lie, it contradicts everything that we know, everything that we've been saying for months. And it's disrespectful to the work of the teams on the ground, to this body of international experts, and to the people of Gaza, to be having this conversation about whether or not it is true while children are dying. It's like we're living in an alternate universe. It's clear that children are starving. They're dying of malnutrition. A group of global experts has said that there is a famine, and those of us here on the ground are seeing it every day in our work, and we're traumatized by it. We are seeing children die every day. So there is no doubt in any of our minds that we're in a crisis, and that the solution to the crisis is to stop arguing about it, to open the crossings, and to allow aid into the Gaza Strip so that children can survive.
Tess Ingram, I know you have to go, but I want to ask you, you're speaking to us from Gaza City. Israel's defense minister has pledged to level Gaza City unless there is an agreement between Hamas and Israel around a ceasefire. Can you respond to the fear on the ground? 1 million people live in Gaza City.
Almost 1 million people live here. That's right. And every second one of them. Half of the population are children. And I think we have to remember that when we're talking about this. We're talking about a population where every second person is a child. And, of course, these children have endured almost 2 years of the unimaginable, and they're exhausted, they're traumatized, they're starving. This is an area where a famine was just classified. This is an area where hospitals are full of injured children. I was talking to doctors today at hospitals in Gaza City about what they're going to do if the worst comes true and they have to try and evacuate. And they don't know where they will go. They don't know how they will remove incubators filled with babies or children from ICU units hooked up to life-saving equipment. This really is a situation that people are lost for words to describe and to plan for, and people are afraid. I was at a learning center yesterday, and I sat with a classroom of children and talked to them about it, and they're scared. Many of them have already been displaced to the south, returned earlier this year, and they don't want to do it again because they know that what awaits them down there is also not safe and not sufficient to meet their needs.
Finally, we just talked to Dr. Mimi Sayed, who is a U.S. doctor who was denied entry, though she had been there several times in Gaza. She said this is increasingly happening for doctors. So you have more and more injured and dying. And is this true? Is this a threat that doctors increasingly are not being allowed into Gaza?
I don't know the details of how many doctors are not being allowed in, but it's true that there's a number of NGOs that work in the Gaza Strip who are at risk of being deregistered in the coming weeks, or their international staff not being allowed to enter Gaza. And that would be catastrophic for the response. So many of these NGOs are critical, not just in terms of medical care, but many aspects of the humanitarian response here in the Gaza Strip. So as a community of humanitarian workers, we've been speaking out about that and our fears around what would happen if we saw parts of this response, not being permitted to continue at such a critical time for the people and children of Gaza.
Tess Ingram, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Spokesperson for UNICEF, stands for United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, speaking to us just after the UN declared a famine in the Gaza Strip. She's joining us from Gaza City. When we come back, Kilmar Abrego Garcia was just freed from ICE detention, has now reportedly been taken back into ICE detention. The government is threatening to deport him to Uganda, a country he has no connection to. Stay with us.
Got no home, I'm just a roaming round, just a wandering worker. I go from town to town, and the police make it hard for me, no matter where I go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
I ain't got no home in this world anymore. A rendition of Billy Bragg by Billy Bragg in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to a case that's become a flashpoint of the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign and crackdown on immigrants. We're talking about Kilmar Abrego Garcia, 30-year-old father from El Salvador who lived in Maryland for years. He was detained by federal immigration officials again today, just days after he was reunited with his wife and children in Maryland after being separated from them for more than 160 days. This morning, Abrego Garcia presented himself to ICE for a check-in. Dozens of his supporters rallied outside ICE's office in Baltimore, where he addressed the crowd before walking into the building where he was taken into custody. He spoke in Spanish, followed by a translator.
Y por eso quiero decirles la gracias a cada uno de ustedes que marcharon, levantaron sus voces y oraron y nunca dejaron de creer y luchar por mi libertad.
And this is why I want to thank each and every one of you who marched, lift your voices, never stop praying, and continue to fight in my name.
Kilmar had just returned home Friday after he was released from jail in Tennessee. The father of three still faces deportation, this time to Uganda, a country he has no connection to. The Trump administration threatened to send him there for refusing to plead guilty in a human smuggling case that Kilmar's legal team has condemned as retaliation for challenging his initial wrongful removal to El Salvador, and for his refusal to accept a plea deal that would have seen him sent to Costa Rica after the completion of his prison sentence. Kilmar Abrego Garcia's anguish began in March when he was wrongfully sent to El Salvador's notorious maximum security SECOT mega prison, along with 260 other immigrants in the United States without due process. A court order forced his return to the U.S. in June. He was visited there by a number of politicians, including Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen. But upon his return, the Trump administration arrested and indicted Abrego Garcia on alleged human smuggling charges for which he awaits a federal trial. His lawyers have filed a motion to dismiss the case based on vindictive and selective prosecution. For more, we go to a lawyer for Kilmar Abrego Garcia's family, Chris Newman, legal director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, known as Endelon. Chris, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain these latest developments of the last few days?
Boy, I mean, like the whole saga, it's been a whirlwind. You know, I'm anxiously looking at my phone. I'm zooming into you live here from California, talking to colleagues on the East Coast. And yes, Kilmar was just apprehended. He was released from jail in Tennessee, returned home to his family, and reported dutifully to his ICE check-in this morning and was apprehended.
So explain, after he was held in El Salvador, first at CECAT and then another prison, the more than 200 people sent from the United States there, more than 200 were sent to Venezuela. This was all clearly illegal, being held in El Salvador. He came back to the United States, but was immediately imprisoned. Explain what he's charged with, and is it possible that they're talking about sending him to Uganda, a country he has no connection to?
Well, I mean, the legal charges and legal maneuvers that are being deployed against Kilmer are unprecedented and almost defy description because they are so unprecedented. The strategy has been incoherent from the Trump administration from the beginning, but the political strategy is clear as day. They are seeking to use the highest office in this land to railroad and prosecute and punish an innocent man. And, you know, again, words escape us. He was never, you know, he wasn't deported to El Salvador. I think the better and more appropriate term is that he was renditioned. This is a guy that has never been convicted of anything. And I think it's actually important to consistently put this case in context. You know, you say that his nightmare started in March. It actually preceded that when he was wrongfully arrested while looking for work at a Home Depot, much like, you know, people are being arrested every day in Los Angeles. The difference is, in Los Angeles, if you get arrested by local police, you're protected by sanctuary laws, which prohibit police and ICE from being, you know, from collaborating. Kilmer was wrongfully arrested by local police. In fact, he was arrested by a police officer who himself pled guilty to criminal wrongdoing, but was then transferred into ICE custody, where he functionally won his case. He won something called withholding of removal, saying that he can't go back to the country that he fled from. He was then, as you pointed out, wrongfully apprehended during that big, you know, a really awful moment in American history where hundreds of people were renditioned to the biggest and worst prison in the hemisphere. When he was brought in there, he was told, like everyone else, that he was never leaving. And, you know, he was, in fact, one of the few, very, very few people to ever leave CECAT, and certainly one of the few people to at least momentarily be a free man, as he was over the weekend. What comes next, honestly, is anyone's guess at this point, because clearly the Trump administration is sort of making this all up as they go along. And we are going to do everything we can in court, in this country, in other countries if necessary, to make sure that Kilmer is ultimately reunited with his family and is able to live a free and prosperous life.
This just in, Kilmer Abrego-Garcia has filed a new federal lawsuit in Maryland. Since it's a habeas corpus case, the petition isn't public, but his lawyer said it challenges the Trump administration's scheme to send him to Uganda. I also want to quote Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, who spoke with Kilmer and his wife yesterday on Sunday. In response to his threats, Trump's threats to send Kilmer to Uganda, Senator Van Hollen said in a statement, quote, Kilmer Abrego-Garcia deserves his day in court, but Trump administration officials who continue to make public statements about his case that have been expressly repudiated by the courts would rather insult judges and circumvent our justice system than uphold people's constitutional rights. Your response, Chris?
Well, right from the start, when the senator and I were momentarily detained in El Salvador, Senator Van Hollen has said that this is a test case for due process for everyone. And part of the reason why the senator, I think, has been and continues to be so invested in the outcome of this case is not only because, you know, he's convinced that we're experiencing a grave injustice for Kilmer and his family, but also because all of our rights are currently under threat. And so one way to look at this is that this is, you know, a high-profile deportation case. The other way to look at it is that this is a high-profile test case as to whether or not we have due process at all in this country. And so, you know, when Kilmer said earlier today that he's grateful for those that have been standing with him. I want to echo that that sentiment and say this is far from over, and it's going to be incumbent upon not just his lawyers to make every argument, including the habeas petition filed just now, but it's going to be incumbent upon anyone who believes in due process and the constitutional system and constitutional values in this country to accompany him, because he right now is not only defending himself and his family, but he's defending all of us.
His lawyer, Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, says the stated intention of the meeting with immigration police today was for an interview. But clearly that was false, the lawyer says. He said ICE did not say why they were detaining him or where they are taking him. Your final comment, Chris Newman.
Look, we've been on a slippery slope in this country for years in which the course in debate about immigration has been used as a pretext and mechanism for incipient authoritarianism. The fact is that Kilmer fled El Salvador, made a great life here in this country, contributed to his community, and now has the types of authoritarian human rights violations that he was fleeing from in El Salvador following him here to the United States. And so Donald Trump wants to close the border for immigrants, but he seems to be importing authoritarian legal and political techniques into this country. And thankfully, Kilmer and his family are standing up, and I will share with you what I shared with him and his family yesterday when we spoke. On behalf of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, we plan to stand with him every step of the way until his civil and human rights are vindicated. This is now obviously a major setback, but we're going to continue this fight to the very end, because it's important not just for him, but for all of us. And I will say, again, there was a fleeting moment of joy when he was able to be with his family. And I think that that gave a lot of people hope, particularly in Los Angeles, because we're seeing apprehensions and human rights violations at Home Depots every single day in Los Angeles, akin to the kinds of things that are happening to Kilmer. And I think the way Kilmer and his family have fought back have been an inspiration not just to the country, but to everyday labor in the United States.
Chris Newman, I want to thank you for being with us, legal director of National Day Labor Organizing Network, and Delon, lawyer for Kilmer Abrego Garcia's family, actually speaking to us from California. Speaking of fighting back, we turn now to George Redis, a disabled 25-year-old U.S. citizen and Army veteran held by ICE for 3 days and nights without charge. We'll find out what he's doing about it. Back in 20 seconds.
Ya no me tapas esta vez, ya somos muchos, porque yo tengo lo que tú quisieras ser. Ya no me tienes ahí debajo y escondida, ya no me insultas porque tienes el poder. Ya no me escondes en el closet de tu casa, que no te debo muchas horas de placer. Es más, tú sí me debes, todos mis años, mis mejores me quitaste. ¿Dónde se fueron? ¿Dónde se fueron nuestros sueños del ayer?
By Lila Downs, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at the Trump administration's mass immigration raids as federal agents round up thousands of people nationwide, including U.S. citizens. George Redis is a 25-year-old U.S. citizen, a disabled Army veteran, who's taking on the federal government after he was detained by ICE for 3 days and nights without charge, arrested during a raid in July on a cannabis farm in Camarillo, California, where he worked as a security guard. Redis was driving to work when he encountered a checkpoint. He says agents broke his car window, pepper sprayed, and violently dragged him out from his vehicle. One officer put a knee on Redis's neck. Another put a knee on his back. During his time in custody, Redis says he was denied access to a lawyer, prevented from contacting his family, placed in an isolation cell. As he remained jailed, Redis missed his daughter's third birthday. He's now filing a legal claim against the Trump administration. Jaime Alaniz, A farm worker died after falling from the roof of the greenhouse during that same immigration raid. For more, we're joined by George Redis, his attorney, Marie Miller, with the Institute for Justice as well. Thank you both for being with us. George, explain what happened. We told your story over and over again. It's a relief to be able to speak to you directly.
Yes. Did you want the story from the beginning?
Yes, please.
I was on my way to work, like any other day. Except today there was, protests going on. There was cars. Apparently there was a raid on my work. And so when I show up, all this is going on. There's piles of cars. I make my way to the front and there's a wall of ICE agents blocking from anyone from going. I pull up and I stop in front of them. I get out my car and try to explain that I'm a U.S. citizen, that I'm just trying to get to work. I'm not there to protest them. I'm not there to fight them. I'm just trying to get to work. I didn't think it would be a problem as long as I told them what was going on. They got hostile. They didn't care what I had to say. They started yelling at me to do different things. It was at that point they started walking towards me. I got back in my car and they surrounded my car. They reversed me to get out of the way for them. I got out of the way. Their cars drove by. And then it was after all that, they reapproached my car. They threw tear gas behind me. The tear gas got into my car and they started banging on my driver's side and passenger side window. There's ICE agents in front of my car telling me to reverse, telling me to pull over to the side, all while other agents are pulling on my door handle, trying to rip my door open, trying to get me out of the car, all while other agents are telling me to do different things. No one was in charge.
You told them you're a U.S. veteran. You told them you're a U.S. citizen. What was their response after they smashed your window?
The response was no response. I was guilty of anything they had thought I was. They didn't need an excuse for anything they did. They just did it.
So when did you join the military? And can you talk about how long you served?
I joined the military in 2018, and I served for 4 years.
And now you were serving as security on this farm?
Yes. I decided to take after security when I got out.
Mm-hmm. And when several of the agents put their knee in your back, put their knee on your neck?
Yes. Yes. One agent put their knee on my neck and another agent put their knee on my back, all while like four or five other agents stood around and watched and just let it happen. They just stood there and watched.
Part of your jailing, you were held with a professor?
Yes. The very first night, they put us in a cell they put me in a cell with one other person, and it was the professor who was arrested that day.
George, you missed your daughter's third birthday?
Yes. Yes, I did. It's something I'll never get back. And it sucks.
Were you able to call home? Were you able to call a lawyer?
No, they didn't give me a chance to at all. I asked when I would be able to speak to a lawyer. They never gave me anything. They never let me call my family. They never told me what I was charged for. They just kind of threw me in there and didn't care. No reason to throw me in there.
I want to bring in Marie Miller with the Institute for Justice. Can you explain the legal course you're taking now with George Redis, U.S. Army veteran, disabled, security on this farm held for 3 days and nights?
Sure. So it's not easy to hold the federal government and its officials accountable when they violate individuals' constitutional rights. But George is trying, and he's doing everything he can to do that. What he's done now is file administrative claims against the federal agencies that are involved. And the reason for that is that there's a statute called the Federal Tort Claims Act. And it is one of the most viable ways to hold the federal government accountable for violating people's constitutional rights. But one requirement before a person can sue the federal government under that statute is that the person needs to file their claims with the responsible federal agencies first, giving those agencies a chance to resolve the claim themselves. And they have 6 months to do that. So this Federal Tort Claims Act puts in this 6 month waiting period before a person can even enter the courthouse door to sue the federal government for rights violations. And it's not the only way to hold the federal government accountable, but it's become one of the most viable ways in recent years, as other paths to accountability have been practically cut off for most people who are victims of civil rights violations by the federal government.
Marie Miller, officials at Homeland Security released a statement saying George Redis was arrested and has been released. He's not been charged. U.S. Attorney's Office is reviewing his case along with dozens of others for potential federal charges related to the execution of the federal search warrant in Camarillo. Your response?
There have been no charges brought. George was never told why he was being detained. When he was released, he was given a form that just says he was detained pursuant to arrest. That's no explanation for his three-day, three-night detention, much less without a phone call, without a hearing before a judge, without access to an attorney, without a shower, with pepper spray all over his body. These are basic violations of George's federal constitutional rights and his rights under California law.
And George, you were transported to a Navy base first?
Yes, I was transferred to the Port Hueneme Navy base.
And then?
First. And then from there, they did our fingerprints and took our picture. And from there, they took us to the detention facility in downtown L.A.
If you can talk about what it means. I mean, you were an Iraq War veteran. You were in a law enforcement adjacent job, right, doing security. Has it changed your view of law enforcement in this country?
I wouldn't say it changed my view of law enforcement because, I mean, we're a nation of laws. Someone has to uphold those laws. It's just important to hold everyone accountable, to make sure that no one is above the law. It doesn't matter who you are, what you do. Everyone has to follow the law. Everyone needs to be held accountable. And I think that's super important, especially for people who don't get the chance to speak or are too scared to speak. Someone has to hold people accountable.
Marie Miller, I want to ask you finally, the Institute for Justice recently won a Supreme Court case with a family in Atlanta whose home was wrongly raided by an FBI SWAT team. We just have 30 seconds.
That's right. The Institute for Justice, along with the clients, won that case at the Supreme Court. That was a Federal Tort Claims Act case, and that case is back down at the 11th Circuit for further proceedings. Georgia's situation is proceeding under the same act, the Federal Tort Claims Act, alongside other potential avenues for relief. And our position is that when officers violate federal constitutional rights, there has to be some way to hold them accountable in court. Otherwise, our rights are simply illusory.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Marie Miller with the Institute for Justice and George Redis, a 25-year-old U.S. citizen, U.S. Army veteran, worked as a security guard and was taken by ICE and held incommunicado for 3 days and nights. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.